Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, June 14th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. Now, before we dive in and chat with our guest, Alexa Miller, I do want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. And the best way to do so is to visit patreon.com/talknerdy so that you can pledge your support per episode. And there are tiers on Patreon. I'm going to give a shout out to the top tiers this week. And they include the coolest person in the solar system, Mary Neva. They also include some of the coolest people on Earth, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, and David J. E. Smith. Oh, also Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, and Ulrika Hagman. We've also got some great friends of Talk Nerdy, including Elise Christie, Robert Christ, Charles Bleel, Bill Hamilton, Carlita, Dave Martin, David Compton. The list goes on and on and on and on and on and on. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart. Don't forget, visit patreon.com/talknerdy to pledge your support, or you can just visit talknerdy.com and you can learn about all the other ways to support the show. So, let's talk about this week's episode. You may remember a while back when I had Lulu Miller, the author of Why Fish Don't Exist, on the show. Well, she recommended her incredible sister for the show. So I think this might be the first time I've had siblings on the show, Alexa Miller. And Alexa started this incredible company called Arts Practica. It's much more than a company. Let me tell you all about it. So Alexa is a visual artist and an art historian who actually co-created Harvard Medical School's course called Training the Eye, Improving the Art of Physical Diagnosis. And out of that, there were really important research outcomes on the impact of arts experiences on medical student training. And then she founded Arts Practica in 2011, and this supports physician success in uncertainty with patients, students, and organizations. So really what they do is they study art in order to improve diagnostics, in order to improve their observational capabilities, and of course, in order to sit better and handle uncertainty in an improved way. And she's worked with a bunch of different organizations, from, as I mentioned, Harvard Medical School to Brandeis University to Boston University, Brigham and Women's Hospital, the Carolinas Healthcare System, the Arts Education Partnership, the University of South Florida, and many, many more. So I'm going to let her explain it a little bit better than I did. So without any further ado, here she is, Alexa Miller. Well, Alexa, thank you so much for joining me today.
It is my pleasure, Kara. Thanks for having me.
So you were recommended for the show way back when I had your sister Lulu on the show to talk about her book. I love this. This is so cool. Sisters. You might be the first sisters I've ever had on Talk Nerdy.
Oh my gosh. I love that.
Yeah. And you know, we talked a little offline. I don't remember if she mentioned you on air or not. She may have, but we actually, after we hung up from the podcast recording, sat and chatted for quite a while about her, you know, interest areas in science, about her book, about my interest areas. And she was like, oh my God, you have to talk to my sister. Aww. The work that she's doing is really, really interesting. And the more I read about what you do, the more I realized that what you do is unique. I've never heard of this.
And when you say this, what do you mean?
So I mean, teaching medical professionals, mental health professionals, but like people within the helping profession, how to have a more critical, a more diagnostic, a more differential eye through learning about art and through really appreciating art, kind of criticism and viewing art in a way that multidisciplinary crossover, this almost like neurological crossover, this link that we see between having a critical view of a very specific field and how it translates into another very specific field is incredible to me. So let's get into that.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think this is the point in the interview now where I want to start interviewing you about your neurological research and the connections you see. So we'll have to, you know, I don't know. Thank you for saying that. And I'm really curious, sort of, there are there are neurological connections there. And, you know, I'm not an academic. I teach in academic settings all the time, and I work with medical faculty a lot. And I do contribute to research, and, you know, projects I've consulted on, I always advise to include research. And you know, I read the research very voraciously, but I don't really consider myself an academic so much as somebody really in the outskirts of that world, focused on translation and teaching and application. But, you know, and I'm not in the neuroscience space, although, like, I do dip my toes every now and then. And every time I do, I'm really blown away at potential connections and also things that are already known in neurology that, you know, really could stand to, like, be applied in educational settings and especially in medicine.
It's interesting that although you may work with neurologists or psychologists or neuroscientists, there's this secondary meta component where they can use our tools to study the work that you do and try and understand why it works. And so let's talk about the work that you do. So is it safe to say your company? Would you call it a company?
Yeah.
Okay. Is Arts Practica. Why don't you give me an overview, kind of the elevator pitch when people say, what is it you do? Just so that we're all working from the same place. And then I want to kind of go back and figure out how you got there. But Let's start with what is it that Arts Practica does?
Okay, great. So I founded Arts Practica in 2011 with the simple mission of supporting physician success in uncertainty. And uncertainty is something that, like, I've actually always been very interested in creatively. I mean, Lulu and I grew up, our family, you know, I don't know how much she got into it with you, but there's a lot of artists and teachers and actors and writers and a lot of support of the creative process in our family. And uncertainty, our parents actually are, you know, our dad is a scientist. Our mom is deep in Russian literature. So it was very normalized to us growing up with these sort of cross-disciplinary conversations. And uncertainty was one of those things that was just like a normal thing. Like, you know, my dad coming from science is like, uncertainty is the purpose of science. And, you know, my mom as a humanist thinking like, wow, people are just such a mystery. Like, you never truly know. And in uncertainty, we always continue to investigate and to wonder and to look. So, and uncertainty to me, like, as a, you know, I actually recently was at my parents' house and I found like a poem I wrote about uncertainty as an angsty 14-year-old. You know, it's just something I think it's just been a topic. Like, I will never fully understand why I've always been interested in, but I have. And I through a series of personal events and family events, I realized how much I cared about the medical learning process being better in uncertainty, and how much harm can happen in medicine as a result of false certainty, and how authentic uncertainty is so much safer. And so I came to this sort of through a really nonlinear way, sort of through an art project I was doing that led me, at the time I was painting and really interested in human resilience and human adaptability. And I was doing all this research on medical images. And that brought me into the space of medical libraries and medical imaging. And that's when I sort of noticed, wow, the way medical contexts and medical like textbooks deal with images, it's like the uncertainty is gone, but it's really there. And we're all sort of like playing along with this idea that it's not there. So I got interested in it that way. And, but I found like I cared, I had a very big passion about it, much more than like was coming through effectively in the project that I was doing at the time. And I knew I really wanted to get into teaching and like the sort of process of how physicians are educated around uncertainty. And so through a series of events, I ended up connecting with a group of faculty and students who were at Harvard Medical School. This was in 2002, 2003, all of whom were artists and who had noticed that, like, the residents on the wards and trainees in medicine, there was like a very steep decline in confidence in being with patients and like sort of performing a very basic observation with patients. And that was, you know, attributed to the rise of technology, which really started spiking like in the late 70s and right around the time that healthcare became big business and connections between caregivers and patients really started to be stressed and break, and clinical time was reduced. And anyway, there's so this group from Harvard Medical School was noticing the impact of that and the ripple effect. And they wanted to teach a very basic course on diagnosis to improve those physical exam skills and to integrate art as a core methodology. And so that was one of those moments in my life where I was just really in the right place at the right time. And I was like, we have a lot to talk about. You know, I started consulting with them on their syllabus, and they invited me to be the teaching artist in the pilot of the course. Harvard was quite skeptical about allowing it, but they permitted us to run this pilot only on the condition that we assess if the course was successful in improving skill and observation. So we partnered with some educational researchers, a team led by Dr. Janet Hafler, and we ran a 2-year longitudinal double-blinded study that showed that students who participated in the course actually made 38% more observations on clinical pictures than a control group of students who'd also wanted to take the course. And they also showed some really interesting changes in their language, like the way they actually described the patients that they saw, the words that they used. They separated out their fact from inferencing more. They used arts terminology like contour and shading and line. So their descriptions became more sophisticated and robust. We published the study in 2008, but we were doing it in sort of 2003, 2004, 2005. But that's kind of how I got started in this work. As a visual artist, I was also at the time, I was very much in the art museum education world. I was the director of education at an art museum and very involved in arts teaching that way. And so that's kind of how I got my start. And it happened at a time where many schools of medicine, dentistry, social work, nursing were increasingly looking to the arts, and especially the visual arts, around some of these issues, related to diagnosis and observation. And so I kind of came into the space at the right time. You were very generous saying, like, you know, what I'm doing is unique, and you hadn't, I must be the only one. And I think I am maybe the only one doing it in the very weird, specific way that I am. But there's actually an entire, you know, there are fields and fields out there in medical humanities and narrative medicine. And also, I'd say, just really great teachers who care about the diagnostic process, which is, like, you know, increasingly challenging. Who are innovating in all kinds of ways to better set up patients and doctors and care teams to see each other and make sense in a system that really makes it very challenging. So I think I gave you the long-winded answer, but
yeah. I think the sad thing though is that this is not still normative. I don't think that most medical students or early career, you know, residents have had anything remotely close to this kind of training. It's special if somebody has been able to really spend time learning about the arts in a way that's sanctioned by their program, like they're actually given the time and the space to do it, and knowing that it has these translational properties. I have a feeling that it It must be that there's a certain sect of individuals who are like, I get it. I get that there's crossover. I look at the literature and I see that this is beneficial. And there's probably still a certain sect of people who's like, this looks like a waste of my time or my energy or my funding. Why would I be training my residents on how to critically observe art? How is that ever going to help them with their patients?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the entire educational program is very focused on a certain set of skills. It's very technical. It has a very narrow definition of expertise. However, I think that, it is increasingly recognized in medicine that, like, for example, like technical expertise really serves a purpose to some extent, but there's like, you know, such a need for adaptive expertise to actually do well clinically and do well by patients, and that aspects of adaptive expertise like just are not, haven't been taught in sort of classic or traditional schooling, and that needs to change. And, you know, I encounter that kind of skepticism all the time, and it doesn't bother me at all. It's very normal. And I actually, you know, embrace it and welcome it, because what it tends to mean is that somebody has a question or a curiosity about it and that it's new. But, you know, they're often, they are, I'd say, reliably like the most, you know, the first to say like the system's not working. I mean, there's so much harm happening in medicine, and so much misdiagnosis is so prevalent, and now with COVID, uncertainty has gotten much more normalized and recognized. It used to sort of be this elephant in the room, but now it's like that is what people are talking about, and there's very broad recognition that they're underprepared and have a knee-jerk sort of negative reaction to uncertainty that's not necessarily accurate to reality. I mean, we're in uncertainty all the time, and is not helpful to navigating it successfully and finding a diagnosis or a treatment plan or a way forward together with a patient, especially a patient who's very different from you.
You know, I think it's such an important point that you're making. Speaking from personal experience, I recently lost a patient. So I'm working on my PhD in clinical psych. Yeah, I mean, it's part of the sort of what I signed up for, because I work in psycho-oncology and I do a lot of end-of-life work. And I find that, you know, all my patients are different. They come from all walks of life. They all have different approaches to their diagnosis. You know, all my patients have cancer, but some of them have metastatic cancer and some of them are, you know, in survivorship. But I find that one of the more difficult circumstances that I see are situations in which the patient is less comfortable with uncertainty. And then it doesn't help when you see a physician, an oncologist or a supportive care medicine physician, who they themselves have a hard time communicating uncertainty, because there's this push-pull between, I want to be a competent provider and I want them to put all their faith and trust in me, but at the same time, we're on this journey together and like we have unknowns, like you have a rare cancer, or we can look at the stats, but we have no idea how long you have or how your cancer is going to go. And that always seems to be a really difficult crossroads when the patient is like, some patients are very open to the idea of like, we don't know and nature's going to do what it does and let's ride this wave. And other patients are like, I need you to tell me exactly what my future looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're putting a finger on exactly why this is so important, is because like the patient doctor, the patient clinician encounters exist for the reason that the patient is in uncertainty, and that if the care, like the caregiver's response to uncertainty, has the potential to like amplify the pain of that,
right? And, or to really call,
or to, exactly, or to be, yeah, with them in a way. And everybody has like very widely ranging comfort levels with uncertainty or different aspects of uncertainty, and it truly is one of these adaptive, artful things to to find the right match, and also to like have the awareness. You know, the one of the things that's very interesting to me about uncertainty is that what distinguishes it from ignorance, because uncertainty is just the state of not knowing, right? It's like the mental state and the emotional state of not knowing, which means it's awareness that you don't know. So it's different from ignorance because it's awareness of ignorance. And so it's a sort of a watching, you know, a metacognitive place. And we actually do have the capacity to, you know, have some control over what that state is like, and to respond rather than to react, and to see how others are doing. And I think, you know, especially in cases of terminal illness, like, you know, cases of cancer, where the patient's uncertainty and the patient's own response to uncertainty is going to be like a driving factor in their well-being and how they're doing. It's so huge. Like, it's pretty, like, and actually some of the most interesting research on uncertainty has come out of the National Cancer Institute, probably for this very reason. So there's a scholar, Dr. Paul Hahn, who had a big career in palliative medicine. And then he's now a full-time researcher. He was at the Maine Medical Center, and he's now at the National Cancer Institute. But his research, there are a number of people who research and like sort of categorize uncertainty in different ways. And the taxonomy that he wrote with colleagues at the National Cancer Institute is probably the one I find the most useful. And I think that there's the way they have organized that taxonomy is like, because it's actionable to patients for the reasons you put your finger on. So anyway, there's like lots more to say about that.
this idea that it's actionable, that it's empowering, that it's sort of, because the thing is, you know, we're often looking to feel more certain, but the important thing is that, yeah, that's like a natural, almost instinctual thing, but it's also important to be able to sit in uncertainty without it causing great distress. And so one of the interventions that I often use, because I come to psychotherapy from an existential perspective, not like a cognitive behavioral or psychodynamic perspective, is that I use the Serenity Prayer, which, you know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God, but the prayer part is neither here nor there. But this idea that we can figure out where we can be active and empower ourselves to affect change, but then also in the places where we don't have control, learn how to not give up, but kind of let go and give into what is happening and remain in the moment and find meaning in what happens, but knowing the difference between the things that we ultimately can control and the things that we just simply, you know, aren't going to be able to change. So how do we then be in it and still live our lives? To me, that's one of the fundamental interventional approaches to the way that I work with my patients. And I can see so much crossover with your interest in uncertainty.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that the Serenity Prayer is like a top resource that we have in uncertainty, right? For like there. And there is so much we can't control. And then there's actually a lot we can. And I think some of the parts that we can control fall into that area we were talking about earlier of like what like really technically oriented schooling doesn't do so well to include. But a lot of people have like, you know, figured out on their own or learned in different domains. And they're not, you know, they probably are actually could be technical, you know, could be technicalized or technicized. And, you know, there's like, we can, when we don't have the answers, we can actually look in other places to find information, or we can, there are ways of, you know, like the way we are in relationship to other people or to the environment that we're in or to ourselves can often, source information in unexpected ways. I'm really interested in that part of like the things that we can control in uncertainty, and especially within our human capacities and our interpersonal capacities and our relationship with the world.
And so kind of taking it back to this methodology and taking it back to the experiential work that you do, which again, I mean, I don't think we quite, you mentioned sort of how it came to be, but we didn't, you know, completely reinforce that, like, you've done these trainings with medical students at Harvard, you've trained individuals at Brandeis, at Boston University, at, you know, these really large institutions, and you've seen really positive outcomes. How, I guess, so there's the uncertainty component of it. There's also the observation component of it. That's a big part of it, isn't it?
So that's the way I think of it is sort of uncertainty is the overarching problem and issue. And another part of my work that's been really important is, like, I've been studying how really masterful clinicians approach uncertainty, and also how it's approached in domains other than healthcare, like in the arts, or like in the military, or in, you know, in science, or in innovation. And those are fields that are far more explicit about uncertainty and embracing of it, and savvy about it, and actually, like, embrace its essential role in how we learn and how we innovate and how we, you know, create new knowledge. Wait, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So, but you asked about observation and uncertainty. So uncertainty is sort of this overarching thing. And then, so I've studied these adaptive approaches to uncertainty, and observation, I would say, is one of the most, like, flexible and always available strategies for being adaptive in uncertainty. And then the way that, and so a lot of my work and the way it started at Harvard, because that course was very much focused on just observation. It wasn't really about uncertainty, but the conversations about uncertainty, it was actually through that experience, through sort of just talking with a lot of students who were learning medicine, that I got tuned in to what the sort of curious anxiety many students feel about uncertainty, like knowing that it's a prevalent reality and a challenge, and feeling like, where do we get to talk about this? Like, where is the training on this? But the arts experience is an authentic, you know, it's like a sim lab, you know, it's just an authentic experience of uncertainty where we can use those adaptive human and interpersonal capacities to find a lot of information and meaning and way forward in the uncertainty of the art, which is by nature, like, going to provoke a different kind, a more positive response to uncertainty, because we bring the expectations to art, like, oh, it's, we're not supposed to know what this is, like, and it's supposed to, you know, pique our interest and provoke us, but it's safe. Like, nobody's dying. Nobody's life is on the line. There aren't big expensive treatments to be considered. There's, like,
yeah, nobody's relying on me to interpret this correctly.
Exactly. And I don't have to defend my expertise. It's really okay for me to, like, not know anything about, like, this work of art and this artist. And even if I did, like, I would still be curious about what this work of art is doing, like, because it's art. That's what we do with it. And so that's how these various, you know, things fit together. So it's sort of always about uncertainty. And then, you know, the observation is one of the kind of key skills. And then the art is the how, the lab really for teaching it. Although, my teaching always, it doesn't just stop in the arts experience. I work really hard to make sure that there's always clear clinical applications. And I like to bring in co-teaching medical faculty as much as possible to make, like, very, very clear links between different kinds of uncertainties that come up in art and how that bridges over into medicine.
So I'm wondering if you can kind of help us take some of this, we're sort of, like, talking around the issue. And maybe if we have a more tangible example of one of the experiential exercises, like maybe you can walk us through what a specific experience within your training would look like, or
sure.
what are some of the kind of out, you know, the things that you're hoping that that the clinicians who take the course would take away, for example.
Sure. So, and I'll just tell, you know, this is where it's often like a little bit challenging to talk about it because the work is such a visual experience and each work of art is like so different and doing very different things. And actually on the Arts Practica website, I recently gave a talk and really like the first 20 minutes of that talk are just examples with visuals and slides of different works of art and like sort of mini stories of the kinds of conversations and clinical bridges that came out of that. So it's on the, I have a page on my website called VTS, which stands for Visual Thinking Strategies. So if you go to artspractica.com/VTS, you can actually watch the video of like a bunch of different arts ones. But I think I'll talk about the one that's coming to mind right now is there's a work of art by the artist Thornton Dial. And it's called No Matter How Raggly the Flag, It's Still Gotta Tie Us Together. And I believe it's at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. But it is a, like when you first look at it, it's one of those things where you look at it and you go, oh, that's a flag. Like it's a big rectangle. There's red, white, and blue. There's like stripes. There's, you know, a blue area with stars. Like it gives you right away that immediate association with a flag. And then you look at it more closely and it's just a big, like, what in the world is this? It's like a, you know, it's made of fabric that looks sort of like maybe t-shirt, a lot of different t-shirts strung together. The paint is actually, the coloring is very splattery. It's not clear if it's paint or if it's some kind of dye or something else, or, you know, it's really mixed in with a lot of different kinds of other fabrics. And you can start to see that it's not like a painting on a canvas, but it's actually like on a metal frame, like maybe like it's got these metallic, you know, like underpinnings that look almost like a mattress spring. And then the more you look at it, there's just more and more and more and more and more in there that is simultaneously like challenging the idea of a flag and also like really loving the ideals of like freedom and togetherness. And it's a work of art that I've used with many, it moves me very personally every time. And I've used it in many workshops and many discussions with different kinds of groups. And every single time there's some common themes that come up, but it's always a profoundly different conversation. And it's part of what I love about this work so much is I get so much out of the arts experiences and I learn so much, you know, just about the ideas and the people, and wonder what the artist, you know, was really getting at. But there's a lot of ambiguity there. And, you know, one of the sort of basic level takeaways is that students or participants find that they can actually find so much and construct so much meaning and possibility just from slowing down and observing and taking in the observations of other people and, you know, just sort of taking that pause. And so they make some contact with and really do some practicing of the behaviors of that, like information gathering and uncertainty. That's not just looking at the computer, looking at the book or what you're supposed to know, like what some external source says, but finding out for yourself, seeing, you know, finding out for yourself what's there and seeing what others mean. So it's working at that level with those skills. And then the work of art itself, just by the nature of the work and like what it's representing and the way it's representing it is, it's a wonderful jumping off point to talk about culture and how, like culture is so, it's a very powerful force in part because it's like, it's so all encompassing, and it's also sort of like hard to describe and put your finger on. And that work of art just brings that up, and it brings up a conversation about, you know, what we take for granted in culture and some of the things in that are very violent. And also, I love using it with healthcare providers in particular, because even though it's a work of art that in some ways looks very violent, there's like a lot of red splattering and blood association, and there's a Confederate flags, like maybe sort of in part of it. But it's also very lovingly made, and made with a lot of like care and tenderness. And it sort of brings to mind the idea of like sort of wrapping or bandaging, and these sort of basic acts of like very loving, healing arts that are at the root of care at the same time. So I love to use that work of art to springboard a discussion about culture and as it plays out in healthcare and healthcare's role in culture in America. So there's more to say about that, but I hope that that's like a mini example of like how we might get started in a workshop.
Well, and it sounds to me like this is so much more than just a means to improving visual diagnostics, for example, a means to being able to look at a scan and notice a lesion, that there's so much more humanity that these physicians are getting out of this, and they may not even know that that's what they're signing up for.
Yeah, that's probably a really good point. I think that's true. And being visually astute, I mean, being able to read a scan and notice those details, like that is a really important part of it. And, you know, I've been in the hospital myself with like a belly full of blood as I had an ectopic pregnancy, and the technician couldn't read, you know, the imaging, and had no, like couldn't tell, you know. And there's a huge need, especially as technologies like ultrasound, like, you know, become more prevalent at the bedside, and like their visual imaging is an important thing, just to be able to read an image at all. That's definitely a part of it. And there are many different ways that we look, noticing details, noticing the whole, like how we scan, what we notice and why we notice that. But I think the place where it, when you're saying about the humanity, like the, yes, that's true. And what I see that sort of coming down to is like, it's not just the skills, but it's the metacognition. It's the awareness of the skills and the awareness of like, okay, I am looking at awareness of oneself as an observer and noticing what is influencing one's perception and what they're, I think that I do focus a lot at that level. Like, you know, after having had the experience that's going to build the visual skill, really spending some time in a reflective space and extrapolating some principles for that really come down to like how we know what we know, how we make sense of the world, and how we co-create an answer and a reality with another person.
Oh, I love that. I mean, you, it's so interesting how you naturally touch on all of these, you know, deep psychological concepts. I keep coming back to my work. And I think the reason that I do is just because there's so much crossover and there's so much relevance. Obviously, it's probably why I was excited to have you on the show. But just this idea, and it's one that I've been grappling with for a long time, and I feel like I finally might have a little bit of a handle on it, that coming from a more skeptical and what we might like even historically call like a logical positivist worldview, that like, you know, we should be approaching the world in an evidence-based way. We should be taking, you know, good scientific outcomes and applying them to decision-making so that we know that we're optimizing our decisions. But at the same time, this idea that, yes, there is an objective reality. And yes, we all can observe it, we can test it, we can interrogate it. But for each of us, there's also a constructed reality that's subjective, that's personal, that's emotional. And both of those things have to exist at the same time. And then you add this extra layer of co-creating, this constructed reality that's co-created between the interested parties. So you've got a patient, you've got a doctor, yes, you have the papers, and yes, you have the labs, and yes, you have the outcome measures, but you also have the feelings that are in the room, and you have the experience of what it means to have cancer or ALS or an ectopic pregnancy or whatever threat you're trying to learn to navigate. And it's so much more than just labs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't even know where to begin with that, but it is so deep and so spot on. And I think the first thing I would say is that people often assume, you know, that because this is in the realm of arts, it's not rational. And I do totally subscribe to rationality, and I aspire to, you know, I believe in it. I have faith. It's something I have faith in, and I aspire to be rational. I'm also willing to like suspend and go out of a rational frame at times that I'm conscious, you know, when I'm doing that. But like there, I think the first thing to say is that there are so many aspects of medicine and medical training that aren't rational. And there's so much research that's out there that there's so much that's known, you know, that like isn't working or doesn't work or works a lot better, that's simply not applied. And the space itself is, you know, and many people find it very crazy making, like, it's not a good setup for having accurate, you know, delivering accuracy to patients. Like, it's not a rational system at all. That a lot of what this work is about is actually is the project of rationality, is helping clinicians see really clearly and be aware of their biases and learn how to, you know, not react and misperceive things out of like a fear-based reaction, but to like slow down and actually have a rationality. So I think that's kind of the first layer. But then there is this other, you know, realm of like meaning, right? And the meaning that we construct. And actually, I'm going to go back to that first layer and say one last thing is like the predominant culture of the system that we're in is actually like, I would say, an inhibitor to accuracy, because we live in a system where like those who hold power are often simultaneously like experiencing threat of losing power or giving up privilege. And that influences perception. And especially there are so many cases. This hurts everybody. It hurts Black people a lot. It hurts white people too. It hurts women. It hurts white men too. You know, it hurts all of us, though some of us at like much staggeringly higher rates, but we're all sort of like hurt by it. That stature, when threat perception gets triggered, you can very quickly lose accuracy. And increasingly, especially as clinical times shorten and doctors are under more and more and more pressure, and there are more and more sort of distractions and things in the way from that encounter, like the threat perception only goes up. And so that's a real inhibitor. You know, our predominant culture is almost a setup to like not have rationality, especially when people are rushed or they're in an environment where there's like a lot of defensive practice. So I just wanted to mention that too about rationality, because like the sort of, but then there is this whole other layer of like, okay, like there's so much we can't control in uncertainty, and what we can do is construct our own meaning, right? And construct our own reality. And when two people can sort of find the knack of doing that together, especially like in a therapeutic alliance, that's just like healthcare at its best, right? That's real healing. That's real moving on with your life and having agency, even amidst really challenging circumstances. That's, you know, the power of choice. And it's not to say that those realities are wrong or not rational. I mean, it depends on like how you look at it. Like, that might make all the sense in the world if your time on earth is limited to a year and you're going to you know, live it in a certain way. Maybe who cares if the world you create, like, isn't the most rational place. So I'd say it's both of those things and having a real sort of consciousness and an agility to be able to do that.
Well, and also there are so many things in this world where subjectivity and rationality are not binary. Like, you know, like if one patient chooses to know as much as they can about their disease because that brings them comfort, and another patient, that brings them a lot of fear. And so they would rather only know what's relevant. Or for example, when I brought up the patient who I recently lost, their approach was, I need to know what immediate decisions I need to make. I need to know only what I'm being faced with right now. I cannot talk about the future. I cannot start talking about future plans or about what ifs or about downstream from here. And it was hard because a lot of the work that I do is preparation for death, legacy work, dignity therapy, you know, meaning focused therapy. And this patient specifically like wasn't having it. But this person's way was, I have to believe I'm going to survive this, even though the evidence doesn't support that. And ultimately, they died relatively quickly. They died without having done the preparation work, but they didn't ever have to go to that place that was too confronting for them. And that was their authentic way to die. It's not how I would want to die. It's not what some people might say from an evidence-based perspective is a more, I don't know, is a better quote death, but it was their death.
Yes.
100%. That was what was right for them.
Yeah. They wanted to go out fighting and like, yeah believing like that 100%.
Yeah. And like, who's to say that that's not rational?
Right. Right.
It's like it worked for them. Yeah. And none of us have the same life circumstances. I've had patients who died who had very young children. Their approach to death was going to be very different than somebody who is elderly, who had already lost their significant other and who was like, I don't have anything left to live for. You know, it's just, it's, and I think it's the same when people are making decisions about their treatment. Do I want to continue with chemotherapy? Do I want to get this radical surgery? Do I, you know, like there are certain things in medicine where there's a clear outcome that a physician who is observing and a physician who can, you know, like we talked about, read the scans appropriately and says, okay, the best, course of treatment, sort of the standard of care is to do X, then Y, then Z. And the patient says, that sounds good. Let's do it. And there are other times when it's like, well, we have options.
Well, I mean, what you're describing, I think, is like a case in point of on the clinician side of like adaptive skill and uncertainty. So I talked about observation, but what that's really about is like always knowing your patient's goals and, and like holding, cherishing their uncertainty and their goals within the their uncertainty as the most important thing, as the guide to decision making. And, you know, even though you are trained in all these forms of end of life therapy, you weren't imposing them on that patient because you put their goals first. And so that's, and like, you know, it's through that you can then extrapolate the right information that you need as you go forward in uncertainty. And so that is like, you know, and those are some things that they really don't teach very well. And it's probably the most common principle, right? Of like seeing a patient, know their goal. That's got to be the first thing.
Yeah. And if they don't even know their own goals, there is this, you know, and I think that's where therapy can be a huge benefit to a patient who is struggling in a medical setting with like, I don't know what it is I want.
Yes.
That to have somebody who helps them, not pushes them in any one direction, but helps them listen to themselves and helps them introspect and develop insight so that they can then say, okay, I never really thought about it that way. But now that I'm thinking about all these available options, it's becoming clearer to me in my mind what I do want. And the sad thing about medicine, and I think probably here as we're, oh gosh, we're starting to run out of time. It makes me so sad. I want to talk to you for hours. One of the things that I hear a lot from medical professionals, and I can imagine this must be a struggle for you in your work, so I'm wondering how you approach this, is when they say, all this sounds great, but I don't have time. You know, how do you deal with that, with the uncertainty and the observation and, you know, these really profound and important lessons that really observing art and experiencing art translate over to medicine. But when the physicians say, yeah, but how do I do all of this in my 15-minute meeting?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing I say is, I mean, it is the question, the challenge of time is really horrible. And I can't tell you how many clinician friends I have who are just like hurting so badly with regards to just how challenging the workplace is right now. So that's legitimate and that's real. And, you know, at the end of the day, I don't want to impose art on anybody. And I think this is to get to skill and adaptive mastery in uncertainty. Like there's a lot of different ways to get up that mountain. And I have a pathway through arts experiences that can break down some of these skills in uncertainty very quickly and in a way that's like not threatening. It's actually even fun and it does connect us to our humanity and each other in ways that ease the pain and expedite like the ease and uncertainty and actually then do save time. You know, these are the moves that like having the knack to notice the right, you know, the discord between the patient's emotions and what they're saying, or having the knack to ask the right kind of question, or doing these tiny, like little micro moves of managing uncertainty at a masterful level, that's actually saves a lot of time in the clinic, it saves a lot of money and, you know, testing and time.
What an important perspective to maintain.
And also like getting, you know, invest a little bit of time investing in a patient relationship up front saves so much time down the road, like just makes those encounters so much easier. So that's what I have to say about time. And I know we're out of time.
I know.
Have to have another conversation.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, because I have to see a patient right now. But yeah. I'm hoping that here in the last like minute that I can ask you, maybe succinctly, I close my show asking my guests the same two questions. And I'm interested to hear your perspectives because just your perspective on your work is so unique. I'd love to hear where your head is at with regards to these two questions. And sorry to put you on the spot. It's okay if it takes you a minute to answer, to think about it. But they're big picture questions. So I'm wondering from you, when you think about the future in whatever context is really relevant to you right now, it could be the future of, you know, your work. It could be something personal. It could be much more kind of like at a humanity, society, even cosmic scale. Number one, what is that thing that's really been keeping you up at night, the thing you're worried about, you're like kind of pessimistic about, maybe even cynical about? But then on the flip side of that, what are you really genuinely optimistic about? What are you sort of authentically and truly hopeful and sort of looking forward to?
So I would say that concerns about the planet keep me up at night, and concerns that I see all the time right now related to that of just like our confusions around like how we define being like prosperous and doing well, like really hurting the planet and like really, you know, literally boiling us and our stuckness in changing those things. And so then the second one was, what gives me hope?
Yeah. What are you really looking forward to?
What am I looking forward to?
Yeah.
So I think a lot about paradigm shift and I would characterize the paradigm that we're in right now really struggling in, but have legacy of, as a white supremacy paradigm. And I see us at a moment of shift. And I actually do believe that, and I think that being better in uncertainty is one of the gateways here, but I do believe that we're on the way to a paradigm of human wholeness that's actually going to serve us much better. And I'm not sure that's going to happen here in America or everywhere, but I actually do believe it's going to happen. And that by nature, we will find a way of thriving by nature of our diversity and really co-creating together as humans and not having like a superiority, inferiority kind of predetermined you know, expectation in many of our transactions in like workplace and school and society. And so I do feel really hopeful about that. And I'm excited about that. And I get to work with people who I believe are actually engaged in that and creating that. And that's what keeps me going.
Oh, I love it. Well, gosh, I wish I could talk to you all day. I've got to be 100% honest. And hopefully you and I can spend some time offline. I hate that I have to run right now. But thank you just so much from the bottom of my heart, Alexa, for joining me today and for sharing your amazing insights. And if you guys want to learn more, you should visit artspractica.com. There are all sorts of great links, as Alexa mentioned earlier. And you can learn a lot more about her work. So again, thank you so much for being here and spending time with us today.
This was my pleasure. And I feel the same way. There's so much more I want to talk with you about. And I'm so grateful for your work with patients and these conversations that you're making available. So thank you so much, Kara.
Oh, and everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.